Oh, you did not make it worse for me. You set me free. You saved us both. You redeemed our past. I can't ask you to forgive me. We're far beyond such terms. And the only atonement I can offer you is the fact that I am happy. That I am happy, my darling, not that I suffer. I am happy that I have seen the truth. Even if my power of sight is all that's left to me now. Were I to surrender to pain and give up in futile regret that my own error has wrecked my past, that would be the act of final treason, the ultimate failure toward that truth I regret having failed. But if my love of truth is left as my only possession, then the greater the loss behind me, the greater the pride I may take in the price I have paid for that love. Then the wreckage will not become a funereal mount above me, but will serve as a height I have climbed to attain a wider field of vision. My pride and my power of vision were all that I owned when I started, and whatever I achieved was achieved by means of them. Both are greater now. Now I have the knowledge of the superlative value I had missed, of my right to be proud of my vision. The rest is mine to reach. And Dagny, the one thing I wanted as the first step of my future was to say that I love you, as I'm saying it now. I love you, my dearest, with that blindest passion of my body which comes from the clearest perception of my mind. And my love for you is the only attainment of my past that will be left to me unchanged through all the years ahead. I wanted to say it to you while I still had the right to say it, and because I had not said it at our beginning, this is the way I have to say it at the end. Now I'll tell you what it was that you wanted to tell me, because, you see, I know it, and I accept. Somewhere within the past month, you have met the man you love. And if love means one's final, irreplaceable choice, then he is the only man you've ever loved. Yes. Her voice was half gasp, half scream, as under a physical blow, the shock as her only awareness. Hank, how did you know it? He smiled and pointed at the radio. My darling, you used nothing but the past tense. Oh. Her voice was now half gasp, half moan, and she closed her eyes. You never pronounced the one word you would have rightfully thrown at them were it otherwise. You said, I wanted him, not I love him. You told me on the phone today that you could have returned sooner. No other reason would have made you leave me as you did. Only that one reason was valid and right. She was leaning back a little, as if fighting for balance to stand. Yet she was looking straight at him with a smile that did not part her lips, but softened her eyes to a glance of admiration, and her mouth to a shape of pain. It's true. I've met the man I love and will always love. I've seen him, I've spoken to him. But he's a man whom I can't have, whom I may never have, and perhaps may never see again. I think I've always known that you would find him. I knew what you felt for me, I knew how much it was, but I knew that I was not your final choice. What you'll give him is not taken away from me. It's what I've never had. I can't rebel against it. What I've had means too much to me, and that I've had it can never be changed.
Do you want me to say it, Hank? Will you understand it if I say that I'll always love you?
I think I've understood it before you did.
I've always seen you as you are now. That greatness of yours, which you were just beginning to allow yourself to know, I've always known it, and I've watched your struggle to discover it. Don't speak of atonement. You have not hurt me. Your mistakes came from your magnificent integrity under the torture of an impossible code, and your fight against it did not bring me suffering. It brought me the feeling I found too seldom, admiration. If you will accept it, it will always be yours. What you meant to me can never be changed. But the man I met, he is the love I had wanted to reach long before I knew that he existed, and I think he will remain beyond my reach. But that I love him will be enough to keep me living.
He took her hand and pressed it to his lips. Then you know what I feel, he said, and why I'm still happy.
Looking up at his face, She realized that for the first time he was what she had always thought him intended to be, a man with an immense capacity for the enjoyment of existence. The taut look of endurance, of fiercely unadmitted pain, was gone. Now, in the midst of the wreckage and of his hardest hour, his face had the serenity of pure strength. It had the look she had seen in the faces of the men in the valley. "Hank," she whispered, "I don't think I can explain it. But I feel that I've committed no treason, either to you or to him."
"You haven't."
Her eyes seemed abnormally alive, in a face drained of color, as if her consciousness remained untouched in a body broken by exhaustion. He made her sit down and slipped his arm along the back of the couch, not touching her, yet holding her in a protective embrace.
"Now tell me," he asked, "where were you?"
"I can't tell you that. I've given my word never to reveal anything about it. I can say only that it's a place I found by accident when I crashed, and I left it blindfolded, and I wouldn't be able to find it again."
"Couldn't you trace your way back to it?"
"I won't try."
"And the man?"
"I won't look for him."
"He remained there?"
"I don't know."
"Why did you leave him?"
"I can't tell you."
"Who is he?"
Her chuckle of desperate amusement was involuntary. "Who is John Gault?" He glanced at her, astonished, but realized that she was not joking.
"So, there is a John Gault?"
he asked slowly. "Yes."
"That slang phrase refers to him?"
"Yes."
"And it has some special meaning?"
"Oh, yes. There's one thing I can tell you about him, because I discovered it earlier, without promise of secrecy. He is the man who invented the motor we found."
"Oh."
He smiled as if he should have known it. Then he said softly, with a glance that was almost compassion,
"He's the destroyer, isn't he?"
He saw her look of shock and added,
"No, don't answer me if you can't. I think I know where you were. It was Quentin Daniels that you wanted to save from the destroyer, and you were following Daniels when you crashed, weren't you?"
"Yes."
"Good God, Dagny. Does such a place really exist? Are they all alive? Is there..." "I'm sorry. Don't answer."
She smiled. "It does exist." He remained silent for a long time. "Hank, could you give up Reardon Steele?"
"No."
The answer was fiercely immediate, but he added with the first sound of hopelessness in his voice,
"Not yet."
Then he looked at her as if in the transition of his three words he had lived the course of her agony of the past month.
"I see," he said.
He ran his hand over her forehead with a gesture of understanding, of compassion, of an almost incredulous wonder.
"What hell you've now undertaken to endure," he said, his voice low.
She nodded. She slipped down to lie stretched, her face on his knees. He stroked her hair. He said,
"We'll fight the looters as long as we can. I don't know what future is possible to us, but we'll win, or we'll learn that it's hopeless. Until we do, we'll fight for our world. We're all that's left of it."
She fell asleep lying there, her hand clasping his. Her last awareness, before she surrendered the responsibility of consciousness, was the sense of an enormous void, the void of a city and of a continent, where she would never be able to find the man whom she had no right to seek. Chapter 4. Anti-Life. James Taggart reached into the pocket of his dinner jacket, pulled out the first wad of paper he found, which was a $100 bill, and dropped it into the beggar's hand. He noticed that the beggar pocketed the money in a manner as indifferent as his own.
"Thanks, bud," said the beggar contemptuously, and walked away.
James Taggart remained still in the middle of the sidewalk, wondering what gave him a sense of shock and dread. It was not the man's insolence. He had not sought any gratitude. He had not been moved by pity. His gesture had been automatic and meaningless. It was that the beggar acted as if he would have been indifferent had he received $100, or a dime, or failing to find any help whatever. He had seen himself dying of starvation within this night. Taggart shuddered and walked brusquely on, the shudder serving to cut off the realization that the beggar's mood matched his own. The walls of the street around him had the stressed, unnatural clarity of a summer twilight, while an orange haze filled the channels of intersections and veiled the tiers of roofs, leaving him on a shrinking remnant of ground. The calendar in the sky seemed to stand insistently out of the haze, yellow like a page of old parchment, saying August 5th. No, he thought, in answers to things he had not named. It was not true. He felt fine. That's why he wanted to do something tonight. He could not admit to himself that his peculiar restlessness came from a desire to experience pleasure. He could not admit that the particular pleasure he wanted was that of celebration, because he could not admit what it was that he wanted to celebrate. This had been a day of intense activity, spent on words floating as vaguely as cotton, yet achieving a purpose as precisely as an adding machine, summing up to his full satisfaction. But his purpose and the nature of his satisfaction had to be kept as carefully hidden from himself as they had been from others, and his sudden craving for pleasure was a dangerous breach. The day had started with a small luncheon in the hotel suite of a visiting Argentinian legislator, where a few people of various nationalities had talked at leisurely length about the climate of Argentina, its soil, its resources, the needs of its people, the value of a dynamic progressive attitude toward the future, and had mentioned as the briefest topic of conversation that Argentina would be declared a people's state within 2 weeks. It had been followed by a few cocktails at the home of Oren Boyle, with only one unobtrusive gentleman from Argentina sitting silently in a corner, while two executives from Washington and a few friends of unspecified positions had talked about national resources, metallurgy, mineralogy, neighborly duties, and the welfare of the globe, and had mentioned that a loan of $4 billion would be granted within 3 weeks to the People's State of Argentina and the People's State of Chile. It had been followed by a small cocktail party in a private room of the bar built like a cellar on the roof of a skyscraper, an informal party given by him, James Taggart, for the directors of a recently formed company, the Inter-Neighborly Amity and Development Corporation, of which Oren Boyle was president, and a slender, graceful, overactive man from Chile was treasurer, a man whose name was Señor Mario Martinez, but whom Taggart was tempted by some resemblance of spirit to call Señor Cuffy Meggs. Here they had talked about golf, horse races, boat races, automobiles, and women. It had not been necessary to mention, since they all knew it, that the Inter-Neighborly Amity and Development Corporation had an exclusive contract to operate, on a 20-year managerial lease, all the industrial properties of the People's States of the Southern Hemisphere. The last event of the day had been a large dinner reception at the home of Señor Rodrigo Gonzalez, a diplomatic representative of Chile. No one had heard of Señor Gonzalez a year ago, but he had become famous for the parties he had given in the past 6 months, ever since his arrival in New York. His guests described him as a progressive businessman. He had lost his property, it was said, when Chile, becoming a people's state, had nationalized all properties, except those belonging to citizens of backward, non-people's countries, such as Argentina. But he had adopted an enlightening attitude and had joined the new regime, placing himself in the service of his country. His home in New York occupied an entire floor of an exclusive residential hotel. He had a fat, blank face and the eyes of a killer. Watching him at tonight's reception, Taggart had concluded that the man was impervious to any sort of feeling. He looked as if a knife could slash unnoticed through his pendulous layers of flesh. Except that there was a lewd, almost sexual relish in the way he rubbed his feet against the rich pile of his Persian rugs, or patted the polished arm of his chair, or folded his lips about a cigar. His wife, the Señora Gonzalez, was a small, attractive woman, not as beautiful as she assumed, but enjoying the reputation of a beauty by means of a violent nervous energy and an odd manner of loose, warm, cynical self-assertiveness that seemed to promise anything and to absolve anyone. It was known that her particular brand of trading was her husband's chief asset, in an age when one traded not goods but favors. And watching her among the guests, Taggart had found amusement in wondering what deals had been made What directives issued? What industries destroyed? In exchange for a few chance nights, which most of those men had had no reason to seek, and perhaps could no longer remember. The party had bored him. There had been only half a dozen persons for whose sake he had put in an appearance, and it had not been necessary to speak to that half dozen, merely to be seen and to exchange a few glances. Dinner had been about to be served when he had heard what he had come to hear. Señor Gonzales had mentioned, the smoke of his cigar weaving over the half-dozen men who had drifted toward his armchair, that by agreement with the future People's State of Argentina, the properties of Danconia Copper would be nationalized by the People's State of Chile in less than a month, on September 2nd. It had all gone as Taggart had expected. The unexpected had come when, on hearing those words, he had felt an irresistible urge to escape. He had felt incapable of enduring the boredom of the dinner, as if some other form of activity were needed to greet the achievement of this night. He had walked out into the summer twilight of the streets, feeling as if he were both pursuing and pursued, pursuing a pleasure which nothing could give him in celebration of a feeling which he dared not name, pursued by the dread of discovering what motive had moved him through the planning of tonight's achievement, and what aspect of it now gave him this feverish sense of gratification. He reminded himself that he would sell his Danconia copper stock, which had never rallied fully after its crash of last year, and he would purchase shares of the Interneighborly Amity and Development Corporation, as agreed with his friends, which would bring him a fortune. But the thought brought him nothing but boredom. This was not the thing he wanted to celebrate. He tried to force himself to enjoy it. Money, he thought, had been his motive. Money, nothing worse. Wasn't that a normal motive, a valid one? Wasn't that what they all were after? The Wyatts, the Reardons, the Dunconias? He jerked his head to stop it. He felt as if his thoughts were slipping down a dangerous blind alley, the end of which he must never permit himself to see. No, he thought bleakly, in reluctant admission. Money meant nothing to him any longer. He had thrown dollars about by the hundreds at that party he had given today, for unfinished drinks, for uneaten delicacies, for unprovoked tips and unexpected whims, for a long-distance phone call to Argentina, because one of the guests had wanted to check the exact version of a smutty story he had started telling, for the spur of any moment, for the clammy stupor of knowing that it was easier to pay than to think.
"You've got nothing to worry about under that railroad unification plan," Orrin Boyle had giggled to him drunkenly.
Under the railroad unification plan, a local railroad had gone bankrupt in North Dakota, abandoning the region to the fate of a blighted area. The local banker had committed suicide, first killing his wife and children. A freight train had been taken off the schedule in Tennessee, leaving a local factory without transportation at a day's notice. The factory owner's son had quit college and was now in jail, awaiting execution for a murder committed with a gang of raiders. A way station had been closed in Kansas, and the station agent, who had wanted to be a scientist, had given up his studies and become a dishwasher. That he, James Taggart, might sit in a private barroom and pay for the alcohol pouring down Orrin Boyle's throat. For the waiter who sponged Boyle's garments when he spilled his drink over his chest. For the carpet, burned by the cigarettes of an ex-pimp from Chile, who did not want to take the trouble of reaching for an ashtray across a distance of 3 feet. It was not the knowledge of his indifference to money that now gave him a shudder of dread. It was the knowledge that he would be equally indifferent were he reduced to the state of the beggar. There had been a time when he had felt some measure of guilt, in no clearer a form than a touch of irritation, at the thought that he shared the sin of greed, which he spent his time denouncing. Now he was hit by the chill realization that, in fact, he had never been a hypocrite. In full truth, he had never cared for money. This left another hole gaping open before him, leading into another blind alley which he could not risk seeing. "I just want to do something tonight," he cried soundlessly to someone at large, in protest and in demanding anger, in protest against whatever it was that kept forcing these thoughts into his mind, in anger at a universe where some malevolent power would not permit him to find enjoyment, without the need to know what he wanted or why. "What do you want?" some enemy voice kept asking, and he walked faster, trying to escape it. It seemed to him that his brain was a maze, where a blind alley opened at every turn, leading into a fog that hid an abyss. It seemed to him that he was running, while the small island of safety was shrinking, and nothing but those alleys would soon be left. It was like the remnant of clarity in the street around him, with the haze rolling in to fill all exits. Why did it have to shrink? He thought in panic. This was the way he had lived all his life, keeping his eyes stubbornly, safely on the immediate pavement before him, craftily avoiding the sight of his road, of corners, of distances, of pinnacles. He had never intended going anywhere. He had wanted to be free of progression, free of the yoke of a straight line. He had never wanted his years to add up to any sum. What had summed them up? Why had he reached some unchosen destination, where one could no longer stand still or retreat?
"Look where you're going, brother,"
snarled some voice, while an elbow pushed him back. And he realized that he had collided with some large, ill-smelling figure, and that he had been running. He slowed his steps and admitted into his mind a recognition of the streets he had chosen in his random escape. He had not wanted to know that he was going home to his wife. That, too, was a fog-bound alley. But there was no other left to him. He knew, the moment he saw Cheryl's silent, poised figure, as she rose at his entrance into her room, that this was more dangerous than he had allowed himself to know, and that he would not find what he wanted. But danger to him was a signal to shut off his sight, suspend his judgment, and pursue an unaltered course on the unstated premise that the danger would remain unreal by the sovereign power of his wish not to see it, like a foghorn within him, blowing not to sound a warning, but to summon the fog.
"Why, yes, I did have an important business banquet to attend, but I changed my mind. I felt like having dinner with you tonight," he said in the tone of a compliment. But a quiet, "I see," was the only answer he obtained.
He felt irritation at her unastonished manner and her pale, unrevealing face. He felt irritation at the smooth efficiency with which she gave instructions to the servants. Then at finding herself in the candlelight of the dining room, facing her across a perfectly appointed table, with two crystal cups of fruit and silver bowls of ice between them. It was her poise that irritated him most. She was no longer an incongruous little freak dwarfed by the luxury of the residence which a famous artist had designed. She matched it. She sat at the table as if she were the kind of hostess that room had the right to demand. She wore a tailored housecoat of russet-colored brocade that blended with the bronze of her hair, the severe simplicity of its line serving as her only ornament. He would have preferred the jingling bracelets and rhinestone buckles of her past. Her eyes disturbed him, as they had for months. They were neither friendly nor hostile, but watchful and questioning.
"I closed a big deal today," he said, his tone part boastful, part pleading. "A deal involving this whole continent and half a dozen governments."
He realized that the awe, the admiration, the eager curiosity he had expected, belonged to the face of the little shop girl who had ceased to exist. He saw none of it in the face of his wife. Even anger or hatred would have been preferable to her level, attentive glance. The glance was worse than accusing. It was inquiring.
"What deal, Jim?"
"What do you mean, what deal? Why are you suspicious? Why do you have to start prying at once?"
"I'm sorry, I didn't know it was confidential. You don't have to answer me."
"It's not confidential."
He waited, but she remained silent.
"Well, aren't you going to say anything?"
"Why, no."
She said it simply, as if to please him.
"So you're not interested at all?"
"But I thought you didn't want to discuss it."
"Oh, don't be so tricky," he snapped. "It's a big business deal. That's what you admire, isn't it? Big business? Well, it's bigger than anything those boys ever dreamed of. They spend their lives grubbing for their fortunes penny by penny. Well, I can do it like that." He snapped his fingers. "Just like that. It's the biggest single stunt ever pulled."
"Stunt, Jim?"
"Deal."
"And you did it? Yourself?"
"You bet I did. That fat fool Orrin Boyle couldn't have swung it in a million years. This took knowledge and skill and timing."
He
He saw a spark of interest in her eyes. And psychology? The spark vanished, but he went rushing heedlessly on. One had to know how to approach Wesley and how to keep the wrong influences away from him, and how to get Mr. Thompson interested without letting him know too much, and how to cut Chick Morrison in on it, but keep Tinky Holloway out, and how to get the right people to give a few parties for Wesley at the right time, and... Say, Cheryl, is there any champagne in this house?
Champagne?
Can't we do something special tonight? Can't we have a sort of celebration together?
We can have champagne, yes, Jim, of course.
She rang the bell and gave the orders, in her odd, lifeless, uncritical manner, a manner of meticulous compliance with his wishes, while volunteering none of her own.
You don't seem to be very impressed, he said.
But what would you know about business anyway? You wouldn't be able to understand anything on so large a scale. Wait till September 2nd. Wait till they hear about it.
They? Who?
He glanced at her, as if he had let a dangerous word slip out involuntarily. We've organized a setup where we, me, Oren, and a few friends, are going to control every industrial property south of the border.
Whose property?
Why, the people's. This is not an old-fashioned grab for private profit. It's a deal with a mission, a worthy public-spirited mission, to manage the nationalized properties of the various people states of South America, to teach their workers our modern techniques of production, to help the underprivileged who've never had a chance, to...
He broke off abruptly, though she had merely sat looking at him without shifting her glance.
You know, he said suddenly with a cold little chuckle, if you're so damn anxious to hide that you came from the slums... You ought to be less indifferent to the philosophy of social welfare. It's always the poor who lack humanitarian instincts. One has to be born to wealth in order to know the finer feelings of altruism.
I've never tried to hide that I came from the slums, she said, in the simple, impersonal tone of a factual correction. And I haven't any sympathy for that welfare philosophy. I've seen enough of them to know what makes the kind of poor who want something for nothing.
He did not answer. And she added suddenly, her voice astonished but firm, as if in final confirmation of a long-standing doubt.
Jim, you don't care about it either. You don't care about any of that welfare hogwash.
Well, if money is all that you're interested in, he snapped, let me tell you that that deal will bring me a fortune. That's what you've always admired, isn't it, wealth?
It depends.
I think I'll end up as one of the richest men in the world, he said.
He did not ask what her admiration depended upon.
There's nothing I won't be able to afford, nothing. Just name it. I can give you anything you want. Go on, name it.
I don't want anything, Jim.
But I'd like to give you a present to celebrate the occasion, see? Anything you take it into your head to ask, anything, I can do it. I want to show you that I can do it. Any fancy you care to name.
I haven't any fancies.
Oh, come on, want a yacht?
No.
Want me to buy you the whole neighborhood where you lived in Buffalo?
No.
Want the crown jewels of the People's State of England? They can be had, you know. That People's State has been hinting about it on the black market for a long time. But there aren't any old-fashioned tycoons left who are able to afford it. I'm able to afford it. Or will be after September 2nd. Want it?
No.
Then what do you want?
I don't want anything, Jim.
But you've got to. You've got to want something, damn you.
She looked at him, faintly startled, but otherwise indifferent.
Oh, all right, I'm sorry, he said.
He seemed astonished by his own outbreak.
I just wanted to please you, he added sullenly. But I guess you can't understand it at all. You don't know how important it is. You don't know how big a man you're married to.
I'm trying to find out, she said slowly.
Do you still think, as you used to, that Hank Reardon is a great man?
Yes, Jim, I do.
Well, I've got him beaten. I'm greater than any of them, greater than Reardon and greater than that other lover of my sister's who...
He stopped, as if he had slid too far. Jim, she asked evenly, what is going to happen on September 2nd?
He glanced up at her from under his forehead, a cold glance, while his muscles creased into a semi-smile, as if in cynical breach of some hallowed restraint. They're going to nationalize Donconia Copper, he said.
He heard the long, harsh roll of a motor as a plane went by somewhere in the darkness above the roof, then a thin tinkle, as a piece of ice settled, melting in the silver bowl of his fruit cup, before she answered. She said,